from KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. URS, a global engineering and construction firm working to improve California's public infrastructure, preserve the state's natural resources, and strengthen the environment. URS.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is the California Report. I'm Susie Rocho, in for Scott Schaefer. Coming up, the Bay Bridge gets ready to unveil its new eastern span. What can the state learn from this massive project? Also, as the Rim Fire continues to burn, we find out how jets are playing a part in fighting the flames.
We've taken all the people out, all the cargo out, all the seats out, and in its place, we've put this 100,000-pound external on the belly.
Plus, the mystery of a 50s R&B star who, on the verge of stardom, disappeared.
He's somebody whose voice wove its way into the lives of people, whose voice became part of a soundtrack to a community.
And we take a trip up north, way up north, where California and Oregon meet, to visit the state of Jefferson. It's the California Report.
During the next 45 minutes, Governor Frank F. Merriam of California will open this great 8 1/4 mile link between San Francisco and metropolitan Oakland to the public.
The San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge opened to the public with much fanfare in November of 1936. At the time, the span was the longest bridge in the world. Now, nearly 77 years later, the bridge is set for another historic opening. This weekend, crews are putting the finishing touches on the bridge's new eastern span. The spark for this massive project was the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, which damaged a section of the bridge and revealed it needed a seismic upgrade. The new bridge is scheduled to open Tuesday morning. And since construction started more than a decade ago, the project has run into a series of disputes involving its design, its price tag, and how safe it will be. Joining me to talk about the Bay Bridge and what's next on the state's big project list is Dan Brecke. He covers transportation issues for KQED News. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Susie.
Well, the bridge is closed now. It's been closed since Wednesday night. What's left to do?
Well, there's a lot of building and demolition and demolition and building. They're taking down the approach on one end. If you've ever gone through the bridge, there's a toll plaza there. They're taking down that approach, and they're going to build a bike lane connector because this bridge comes complete with a bike lane that goes halfway across the bridge. And they have to finish some work to connect the new bridge with the famous Yerba Buena Tunnel. And they say they're doing some paving work as well, and they say all that's going very fast.
The final cost for the bridge is over $6 billion. It started at about $1.1 billion many moons ago. But more than the cost, the safety of the bridge has been called into question. Everything from steel rods and bolts that were deemed faulty, and now there's investigations. Now, what are the authorities saying about this?
Well, the key reason to build this bridge in the first place was, as you noted, the Loma Prieta earthquake and the revelation that we had a serious safety problem here. So the key ingredient to this new bridge was a seismic safety structure built into the deck of the new bridge, which involves some bearings that allow the bridge to move if there's an earthquake. When they started to finish the installation of that, the gigantic rods or bolts that were holding this in place started to snap. So that started to raise questions about the steel in the bridge. Many questions later, many tests later, they seem to have found a way of retrofitting this seismic safety structure so it'll work as designed. And most of the other steel in the bridge seems to be good enough for prime time. And I talked to Steve Heminger, the executive director of the Metropolitan Transportation Commission here in the Bay Area, and he sounded relieved and a little wistful that the bridge is about to be finished.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of bridges to fix. We have really lived through a golden era of bridge construction in the Bay Area, and we've built more bridges and fixed more bridges than at any time in our region since the Golden Gate and the Bay Bridge were built in the 1930s.
Let's get back to the cost question here, Dan. What are taxpayers getting for their money besides a structurally sound bridge?
They're getting a real landmark structure. It's called a self-anchored suspension span. It's unique. It is beautiful. Reporters I'm talking to who have been out on the bridge deck the last couple of days are awestruck by it.
Well, we're getting a beautiful bridge, but are we going to get more capacity on the bridge? Are there going to be more lanes?
Well, that's an issue. No, we had five lanes going across the bridge before, and we're going to have five lanes when the bridge reopens next week. So there is no new capacity for all this money we've spent.
What do you think the state can learn from the construction of the new Eastern Span? Do you think there's going to be more scrutiny on other big projects that the state has lined up?
Well, I think there will be a lot more scrutiny. One of the members of the state legislature, Senator Mark DeSaulnier from Concord, has talked a lot about the need for more oversight in these big infrastructure projects. So that's a certainty. And then there's a lot of skepticism about these major projects like the Delta Tunnel projects, which could be over $20 billion, and the California High-Speed Rail project, which could be
over $68 billion at this point.
$68 billion at least. And how do you bring those projects in even close to that? So I think there's going to be both skepticism and resistance maybe to going ahead with some of these things, and we've already seen that.
So are we going to see any major bridges being constructed in the state of California?
I don't think we're going to see anything like this Bay Bridge project for a long time, if ever, in our lifetimes. I think what we will see and what transportation planners are talking a lot about is how to get more capacity, better use out of our existing infrastructure. Earlier, I spoke to Alex Byan, and he's a professor at UC Berkeley and works for their Institute on Transportation Studies. And he said the public can probably get more bang for its buck investing in things like software, better data from road sensors, and maybe hardware upgrades.
But these are fairly minor costs in comparison to what it takes to build a new road or to build a new bridge. And so in a high-tech driven place like California, this is a particularly attractive opportunity.
So looking ahead to these other projects, Dan, how does smart technology play into those?
There are a bunch of things that we're familiar with, for instance, metering traffic onto the freeway on the entrance ramps. But there are other things that are going to come into play that grow out of collection of data by road sensors and through social media. So, for instance, traffic engineers will be able to spot where traffic is almost minute to minute and actually regulate the speed of lanes. That's a project that's actually happening on some Bay Area freeways already or is in the midst of being installed. The traffic planners also talk about building what they call hot lanes. This is something that's happened in both Southern and Northern California. They're essentially carpool lanes that you pay for. And that is another way of adding capacity without necessarily building new pavement.
So, Dan, are we going to see you on the bridge on Tuesday?
You will see me on the bridge on Tuesday. I will drive. I will walk. I will bicycle. I'll be there in every mode I can be.
Dan Brekke covers transportation issues for KQED News. Thanks for joining me, Dan.
Thanks, Susie.
Crews are cautiously gaining ground on the Rim Fire, which as of Friday is 32% contained. It's already scorched more than 200,000 acres of the Sierra, but could have spread even farther if the federal government hadn't brought its biggest weapon to the fight. Grace Rubenstein has more.
Wildfire crews call them the big boys. DC-10 jumbo jets, the kind of passenger airliners you might once have ridden to London. They swoop down at strategic moments over the firefighters on the ground. Each plane dumps a massive payload of iron red fire retardant, weighing in around 100,000 pounds. That's at least four times more than a standard air tanker.
It's kind of the difference between a Dixie cup and a big gulp.
Forest Service spokesman Mike Martin has seen the big boys in action. There are two of them, owned by the company 10 Tanker Air Carrier. Owners say they're the only two retrofitted firefighting DC-10s in the world, and the Rim Fire is using both.
We've taken all the people out, all the cargo out, all the seats out, and in its place we've put this 100,000-pound external on the belly, and then we've light-loaded it with fuel because we're never going more than 400 or 500 miles instead of going all the way to Europe.
Rick Hatton, CEO of Ten Tanker, watches as crews fuel up his giant plane at Castle Airport outside the San Joaquin Valley town of Merced. The plane fueling now used to carry passengers for American Airlines in the 1970s and 80s. It's 5 stories tall, and the workers look minuscule scurrying beneath it.
Well done. Not too bad.
From the runway, we can see a smoky brown haze hanging over the Sierra, with a billowing white plume at its center.
Boy, it looks like a mushroom cloud.
When this plane reaches the fire zone, it will come in at precisely 150 knots and 200 feet above the treetops. It rains a line of retardant up to 3/4 of a mile long and 60 feet wide. Customized software controls the tank doors to release the red liquid, also called mud, at a constant rate of flow.
You don't tend to think of airplanes like this turning steeply, because when you're riding them from L.A. to New York, they don't turn steeply, but they can.
The point is to slow down the fire long enough to give ground crews a chance to cut fire breaks using bulldozers, picks, and shovels.
That gives us time, more time, to put up that buffer zone.
That's Forest Service spokesman Lee Bentley at a firefighting base camp about 50 miles away. He says this is the first time he's seen 2 giant tankers used on the same fire. The first plane started flying in 2006, while the second debuted just last year. Bentley calls the big boy's impact tremendous.
I think it's one reason that Tuolumne City is still there. I really do.
All that muscle costs more than a conventional air tanker. Actual costs can vary by day, but officials on the Rim Fire are budgeting just over $12,000 an hour for the DC-10s, compared to $8,700 for its smaller cousins. Hatton argues that considering how much more mud the DC-10 drops per flight, it's actually a significant cost savings. He's hoping the Forest Service finds the big boys valuable enough to have him build more.
We'd like to build a fleet. We think the nation needs 6 or 7 or 8 of these aircraft.
Back at the airfield, Captain Kevin Hoff sits at a table in the cavernous, empty body of the plane, doing paperwork. He's already made 5 runs today. Among all the blazes he's seen, he says of the Rim Fire,
it rates right up there. I think everyone's in for a long haul here. Yeah, unless Mother Nature cooperates and dumps some rain on us.
Minutes later, the call comes for another run. Hoff fires up his engines, taxis down the runway, and takes off, heading again for the smoke storm that, even from here, makes this monster plane look small. For the California Report, I'm Grace Rubenstein.
You can see Grace's photos of the giant tankers at californiareport.org. 2 years before Richie Valens released his first single, Come On, Let's Go, East L.A.'s Little Julian Herrera had a hit with Lonely, Lonely Nights, which made him the first Chicano R&B heartthrob. But Little Julian had a secret identity, and at the cusp of stardom, he disappeared. Alex Schmidt reports on the mystery that still continues to this day, and the people who'd like to solve it.
This is his first single right here. When I first heard Little Julian, I go, wow, you know, that this guy's a Chicano guy. I mean, Little Julian Herrera. And, I mean, I could relate to him, you know. He was one of us, you know.
For his whole life, Gene Aguilera has been enthusiastic about music. Today, he owns 5 guitars, 5 fully functional Seaberg jukeboxes, and over 10,000 records. But he's still searching.
I looked. I talked to DJs. I talked to promoters, I talked to other musicians, and I just could not flush him out.
Little Julian Herrera was one of the defining voices of Chicano R&B, who came out of East L.A. in the late 1950s. Recently, Aguilera has been working with another Herrera fan to see if they can track him down. The latest wild goose chase started when a man contacted Aguilera, claiming to know Little Julian personally.
He says, okay, well, go home. After work, go home, but you got to be ready because I'm going to go to his house and then we're going to call you from there and then we'll make a meeting point. And so I stayed home from Friday night till like Sunday night waiting for that phone call that never came.
Still, Aguilera has been determined to find the man who wrote the soundtrack of his adolescence, a man who piqued the interest of other music folks around L.A.
Every time I would talk to a musician, every time I would talk to a collector, no joke, within the first minute or two of our conversation, they would say, "Hey, you ever heard of Little Julian?"
Josh Kuhn teaches and writes about music at USC. He says Little Julian Herrera never became a big star outside the notable Chicano music scene in East L.A. But since his disappearance, he's developed a notoriety among collectors and musicians that he never knew while he was active. He's become a sort of legend. Little Julian's Los Angeles story starts somewhere near here in the Boyle Heights neighborhood east of the L.A. River.
He hitchhiked across the United States and ended up in Boyle Heights when he was 13.
That's Gene Aguilera again.
He got taken in by a Latino family in Boyle Heights whose last name was Herrera, and he assumed that last name of Herrera.
Herrera adopted a Latino identity, though, and we'll get to this later, he was actually someone else. About 4 years after he arrived, East L.A. had a vibrant music scene. Herrera hung around at shows, met the right people, and soon he was performing and recording himself.
He was an upper. I mean, he was just always excited about something.
Bernie Garcia is a saxophone player who played several shows with Julian in the club scene around East L.A.
Had a lot of charisma. He sang his butt off, as they say. Sang his butt off.
Then in 1958, a cop showed up at the home of Herrera's record producer, Johnny Otis. The cop was looking for one Ronald Wayne Gregory. The photo he showed Otis, it was of Little Julian Herrera. Johnny Otis learned that Julian Herrera was actually a Hungarian Jew. Herrera, or Ron Gregory, was arrested at age 19. His crime was forcible rape. Since Los Angeles County court records with details about the incident are confidential, exactly what happened is murky. You will cry, you will cry if I leave you. You wouldn't have had to if you just would. But that wasn't the end of Little Julian. After he spent time in jail, he reappeared and started playing and recording again. But things took a downturn. There are rumors that he was drinking and violent.
In fact, he told me he had some legal problems and he had to get out of town for a while. I said, yeah, makes sense.
That's Bernie Garcia again, the sax player. Julian called him with a proposition to play gigs in Tijuana. After a wild week of performing and partying, Garcia decided it was time to head home.
After I left the gig, he called me up and asked me if I wanted to reconsider. And I said, no, I'm going to pass, pal. You know, I'm married. And that was it. I haven't heard from him since. I wish he were still alive. I'd love to see him.
What would you say to him?
Hey, babe, what's happening? You know. Any gigs? Let's do something together, man. I'm tired of sitting around waiting for your butt. Let's do something. That's probably what I'd say.
Whether he knew them personally or not, Little Julian Herrera had a lasting impact on many.
He's somebody whose voice wove its way into the lives of people, whose voice became part of a soundtrack to a community. And so he became more of a kind of cultural emblem than an entertainer.
Right now, Gene Aguilera is working on a definitive history book of Chicano music. Finding Little Julian, he says, would make it complete. For the California Report, I'm Alex Schmidt.
I still remember when I first met you. I locked you in my heart and threw the keys away. Yes, Linda, I still remember.
If you drive through the high desert, forests, and mountain valleys of Northern California and Southern Oregon, you'll take the State of Jefferson Scenic Byway. You can check out the jam band, The State of Jefferson. And if you're searching for the local public radio station, you'll hear this.
You're listening to the Rhythm and News Service of Jefferson Public Radio, committed to supporting lifelong learning and the arts in the mythical state of Jefferson since 1969.
That's because many people living there don't really identify with Oregon or California. They say they live in the state of Jefferson. Reporter Lisa Morehouse visited the heart of this region, Siskiyou County, to find out why and to see how young people trying to make a life there fit into that heritage.
Sam Lanier is a young entrepreneur. On a Saturday morning, he's at his office in the historic town of Dunsmuir. This is a heavily forested region, and for decades, logging was a robust industry. But unlike some people here who get nostalgic or angry about logging's decline, Lanier is pragmatic.
We're not going to see logging come back. It's too massive a change to bring back the mills. That's not my hope. I mean, okay, we have these lands. What can we do with these lands?
Lanier has wildfires on his mind. Wildfires draw business in the summer when crews come into towns needing food, lodging, and supplies. But Lanier and his partners started a year-round tech company called Fire What in 2010. The business trains firefighters from across the country, and it also consolidates information about wildfires on an app and a website. Last year, the site had 56 million hits. That kind of success is encouraging in this region, where many worry that high unemployment will drive young people away.
We want to prove that we can have a new economy and we can do something different and we can kind of fight the odds. And yeah, it might take us a little while longer, but we're not going to give up.
Siskiyou County will survive on fire, flood, or food stamps.
Rick Jones owns a general store in the tiny former logging town Syed Valley, west of Wairika.
Fires and floods bring in money, work for folks and that want to work, and they don't want to work, they're on the food stamp program.
This region abounds with forests and rivers, but aside from a burgeoning marijuana industry, there's not as much work on the land as in the past. Most is in the hands of the government and managed with regulations, which is one of the reasons many people return to the idea of this being a separate state, the state of Jefferson.
The state of Jefferson is a state of mind now. It would be nice if it would be the state of Jefferson, but it won't happen because they'll never let California split the state.
That doesn't keep people from at least identifying with the notion. Along with dry goods and batteries, Jones stocks his shelves with State of Jefferson gear. He wears suspenders and a T-shirt sporting the seal of the State of Jefferson. It's painted on the outside of his store, too, and on the post office and the cafe.
It's a circle of two X's in the middle of it, double-crossed by the government back in the early 30s and 40s.
Since the time of California's statehood, there had been attempts to make this region separate. By late 1941, things came to a head when many here felt Sacramento and Salem ignored their infrastructure needs, like roads to develop timber and mining industries. Outside Wairika, armed young men blockaded traffic, handing out copies of Jefferson's Proclamation of Independence. Now, some say this was a sincere attempt at secession. Others call it a publicity stunt. Regardless, the uprising quieted with the attack on Pearl Harbor. Today, many people from across the political spectrum still identify as being residents of the state of Jefferson more than California.
What we share as Californians is fantasy.
Peter Laufer is a journalist who's publishing a book about the state of Jefferson.
We are fantasy land, and Jefferson is part of the California fantasy. But so is turning on the tap in Los Angeles, where there is no reason for there to be water. And so is hanging out in San Diego, thinking that somehow you're better than the people in Tijuana when it's one big city.
That fantasy remains powerful in this place where many residents feel they don't have much political clout. Siskiyou and surrounding counties are physically large, but their populations are tiny. In the last few decades, a Jefferson movement has grown, made up of conservatives focused on decentralized government. Natural resource issues are contentious, and Laufer says people polarize around their positions, even though historically, State of Jefferson residents consider themselves individualistic.
In fact, around the issues of conflict, there's an awful lot of groupthink. And so if there are those who can figure out how to transcend that, perhaps they are the future of the so-called state of Jefferson.
People like tech entrepreneur Sam Lanier and the Harris brothers. Rich Harris and his three brothers, all in their 30s, raise cattle and grow alfalfa like most of their neighbors in the stunning Scott Valley west of Yreka. They're also experimenting with raising pigs. Harris walks out to a pasture of piglets and sows who rush at the sound of his feed buckets. A few years ago, they started Four Brothers Heritage Farms, a meat CSA selling directly to consumers in Portland and San Francisco with a slick website and a Facebook presence. So far, business is good.
Since we started doing this, like, we don't have pork in our freezer anymore.
But sometimes it's like, oh, that's a bummer. I really want some pork chops right now.
Harris feels good about raising pigs, which he says are more sustainable than cattle and alfalfa. Their diet requires less water, and water is a big issue here. All four brothers went to college in Oregon, worked across California and the West before coming home.
The more people you meet and see how they live, you take a little bit of each place with you, and it comes back. It just helps improve the area that you have.
The Harris brothers try to innovate so they can maintain a ranching heritage.
That's the whole thing about the state of Jefferson is this place won't get bulldozed.
That's Rich's brother, Preston Harris.
It's not going to get turned into million-dollar estates with quarter horse ranches and wine country, and that's not the way people want this to develop.
Preston Harris straddles multiple worlds. He's strident about maintaining ranchers' water rights, and he's also leading water conservation efforts involving ranchers and state agencies. He believes if his community develops solutions to big problems, they'll have more freedom to keep doing what they love.
What happens is at the end, it develops almost a pride of, you know, we are the state of Jefferson. We're not California, even though it's kind of a mythological pride because it doesn't exist. But it doesn't mean that someday it won't.
Really?
Maybe. You never know. I think it would take an act of God, but, you know, what the hell?
And whether that pride comes through statehood or a strong shared identity, Preston Harris hopes that he and his neighbors can avoid what he calls the mess that is California. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in the state of Jefferson.
You can see Lisa's photos from the state of Jefferson at californiareport.org. And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. You can always find us at californiareport.org. You can see what music we played as well as listen to past stories. And why not like us at Facebook at facebook.com/thecaliforniareport. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, Chad McClymonds, and David Marks. Our interns are Carly Naren and Rachel Marcus. The editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Ingrid Becker, and Bruce Kuhn. I'm Susie Rocho. Scott Schaefer returns next week. Have a great Labor Day weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children.